Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulaby. This week on Culturetopia, a story of feathers and film as a real-life birdwatcher talks about the new movie The Big Year, starring Steve Martin, Owen Wilson, and Jack Black, as hardcore competitive birdwatchers. 2011 is a year of more than a dozen movie remakes, not even counting the sequels. Critic Bob Mondello says maybe that's not such a bad thing. And the massive popularity of some electronic music festivals has earned mainstream media scrutiny that reminds one reporter of the coverage of Woodstock. But first.
Hey, 50 years ago this week, in 1961, a novel by Joseph Heller went on sale. Catch 22 begins with an American airman assigned to censor the mail going home from the troops during World War II. Rather than just blacking out the sensitive parts, he starts blacking out passages at random, or entire letters. In the half-century since Catch-22's publication, the novel's title has entered the language, a metaphor for bureaucratic absurdity. But it took a while for the book to catch on, as NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
In August of 1944, Joseph Heller flew on a mission over the French town of Avignon. Sitting in the plexiglass nose cone of a B-25 bomber, Heller faced the very real possibility of death for the first time. That mission, says Heller biographer Tracy Doherty, shaped the way Heller thought about war, a sensibility that permeates his first novel, Catch-22.
After that mission over Avignon, Heller really understood that this is not an abstraction. They are out to kill me personally, and he didn't like it, and Yossarian doesn't either.
Yossarian is Heller's nimble creation, an everyman soldier who is trying as hard as he can to get out of the war. But the more he tries, the more he's caught in the famous catch. In this scene from the movie based on the novel, the actor Alan Arkin, who played Yossarian, spells it out.
Okay, let me see if I got this straight. In order to be grounded, I've got to be crazy. And I must be crazy to keep flying. But if I ask to be grounded, that means I'm not crazy anymore and I have to keep flying.
You've got it. That's Catch-22.
When Catch-22 was first released, it was not universally well received. Until then, books about war tended to be serious works, often tragic in tone. Heller's war was a black comedy, filled with orders from above that made no sense and characters who just wanted to stay alive. The novel seemed to offend some reviewers. The New York Times called it an emotional hodgepodge, but other critics took on the book as a cause.
It seemed to me like the first genuine post-World War II novel.
Robert Brustein reviewed Catch-22 for the New Republic. He says he was blown away by the book and the way Heller's depictions of war turned the idea of heroism on its head.
He was using a tone that is not normally used when you talk about war, especially wars fought by Americans. I mean, the language we use when we refer to our soldiers as our brave, heroic boys and so forth, we don't use language that indicates that they might be slightly insane. And that's what Joe Heller was one of the first brave men to do. And he ran into a firestorm as a result.
By the time Catch-22 came out in paperback, the word of mouth was more positive than negative, and Catch-22 became a bestseller. But Tracy Doherty says it was more than just the praise of critics that turned the tide in its favor.
Really what turned the tide, I think, was that the Vietnam War began to heat up and was more and more in the news, and Heller's book seemed to prophesy what was happening.
The young people who took to the streets to protest the war embraced Catch-22. Heller may have based the novel on his own experiences in World War II, but the voice that emerged captured the tone of a new generation, which had lost its respect for authority and refused to take anything at face value.
In the mid-60s, when what was being stated publicly, particularly about the Vietnam War, but about other social upheavals, what was being stated publicly was clashing so obviously with the images we were seeing on our television screens. And so I think in a large sense, the entire culture began to distrust language. And we were being told one thing and seeing another. And there's the paradox. And I think that's the heart of Catch-22.
But it wasn't only young people in anti-war protests and on college campuses who were reading the book.
Well, I was stationed with the 25th Infantry Division in Cu Chi, Vietnam, which was about 30, 40 miles southwest of Saigon on the north end of the Delta.
Mark Anderson read Catch-22 while serving in Vietnam. He carried it with him on forays into the jungle and lent it to other soldiers who wanted to know what he was reading.
I would tell people about it, and they'd get a kick out of it, and I'd let them have it for a day or two, and they'd read sections of it. But I think it had a lot of resonance with the Vietnam soldiers, again, because they were drafted. They didn't choose to be there, and it was pretty apparent once you had been there for a little while that this is silly. We're fighting peasants with BB guns with a 500,000-person army.
Anderson says Catch-22 took one of life's worst experiences and made it funny. Heller understood completely what soldiers encounter in war and identified with their frustration about getting caught in a situation over which they have no control. He turned that frustration into his famous Catch-22, an idea which perfectly captures the absurdity of war and the mind-numbing bureaucracy that supports it. Heller's humor, says Anderson, is what makes the book work.
It seems to make more clear and more obvious the futility of the war, because Yossarian just made fun of everything about it and everyone in it continuously, nonstop. And he did it in such a way that you couldn't help but laugh out loud at him. And I think the humor is unique, and I think the humor is what makes the book so powerful.
Catch-22 is a concept everyone can understand. That's why it so quickly became part of the language, a phrase to be called upon when there seems to be no way out of the traps life can set for you, and when humor really is the best response. And that, says Robert Brustein, is why the book has endured.
It's amazing to me that it's 50 years old, because I feel as though it was written yesterday. And I do think it still speaks to us. I think people should start reading it again and then looking it around at our political leaders, and they'll see them in a whole new light.
When Joseph Heller was promoting Catch-22, he was interviewed on NBC's Today Show by John Chancellor. As it turned out, Chancellor was such a fan of the book, he had stickers made up that read, "Yossarian Lives." Not long afterwards, bumper stickers started popping up all over the place. 50 years later, the message on those bumper stickers isn't out of date. Yossarian lives and seems to have quite a few years ahead of him. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
The movie Moneyball is just one new film based on a true story. That one is about baseball's Oakland Athletics. This weekend, an even more ambitious Hollywood film opens about the competitive sport of birdwatching. And Mark Uricki of member station WKSU reports that the real story behind it is just as improbable as making a studio comedy about the thrills of spotting birds.
Director David Frankel had just made The Devil Wears Prada and was about to start filming Marley and Me when he was pitched the idea of a movie on bird watching. His reply was, "Ow."
That was my first reaction. Of course, that was the studio's first reaction. There's a lot of, you know, downcast eyes and sideways glances and, you know, eyebrows shooting up.
The pitch was based on the 2004 nonfiction book The Big Year. It followed three men who set out to find the greatest number of bird species in North America for the calendar year 1998. In birding circles, that's called doing a big year. Many birders have a goal of spotting 700 species in their lifetimes. These guys were each trying to find 700 in 1 year. One of them was Greg Miller. Was he surprised when he heard Hollywood was turning his story into a movie?
Yeah.
Miller grew up a Mennonite in the Amish country of Ohio. He started birdwatching with his father when he was just a preschooler. In the late 90s, he wasn't planning a big year because he was working a full-time job as a computer coder, working to eliminate Y2K bugs. But then he received his final divorce papers on December 31st, 1997.
In 1998, I decided, I'm an emotional guy, so rather than wallowing around in self-pity, I would go bird watching to keep myself distracted, because it's something that totally takes me away. I walk into a woods, and my regular life just fades away.
The two other real-life birders portrayed in the movie were both born in the Bronx. Both were well-off, retired businessmen. At first, Miller didn't know that others were also out to set the record that year.
By May, I found out about another guy who was probably doing a big year but never admitted it. And then it was midsummer when I found out about the second guy. And both those guys, Al Levington and Sandy Comito, had done terrifically well, and I realized I had serious competition that year.
In the film, the characters based on Levington and Comito are played by Steve Martin and Owen Wilson.
You ever get the feeling you're being followed?
Hello, Master.
How you doing, Stu? Still filling those weekends, I see. Unless you and your son here are doing a big year.
Kenny Bostick, this is my friend, Brad Harris, who's also not doing a big year.
Big-footed goose! Big-footed goose, other end of the boardwalk!
Both of them are wealthy. Both of them had the whole year, and there was me literally working on my contract to pay for my next trip, maxing out 5 credit cards, borrowing from my parents, scraping to make ends meet, doing things on the cheap.
Greg Miller is a man who probably gets more hugs per mile than any man I've ever met.
Mark O'Masek is the author of the book, The Big Year. He says the lovable roly-poly Miller spent days in the Dakotas living off nothing but a jar of peanut butter and a bag of pretzels. But all three men had to rush all over the continent whenever someone spotted a rare bird.
These guys talk about how they would fly from Baltimore, you know, all the way to Southern California with hopes of seeing a gull. And the longest part of that trip is the rush from the car out to where the bird is being seen. You don't want to fly thousands of miles and spend hundreds of dollars to be able to see a bird, only to have it leave just as you arrive. Every hardcore birder has got a horror story about that sort of story.
Stuck off, headed north, probably be in Iceland by Friday. Boy, she was a beaut, too. Hey, is that a calliope? Nah. Sorry to disappoint you, boys. Again.
To get more than the 675 native birds to North America, the men went to well-known spots where storms would blow in non-native species called vagrants. One so-called bird funnel is in Alaska. In fact, Miller and Sandy Comito ended up at the same time on Attu, the westernmost Aleutian island, where a big storm is always blowing in.
You're in a very remote place. We had 70-mile-an-hour winds blow in from the west, from Asia, for 3 days in a row. And it started raining birds out of the sky, so there were olive-backed pipits falling out of the sky.
There's going to be major fallout in a few hours.
Nuclear fallout?
Bird fallout.
Some of the more rare species that we saw there included oriental greenfinch. There was a great knot, which was the first for that island, and a good record.
Greg Miller saw 212 species in one day. Despite the competition and some gaming among the three, author Mark O'Masek says the birders did help each other. And what's more remarkable, their lists are tabulated strictly on the honor system.
I mean, at one point, Al Levington told me, he said, you know, in a big year, there's no trophy, there's no cash prize, there's no parade. Why do you do a big year? If you cheat in a big year, who are you cheating?
In the end, all three men recorded more than 700 species that year. Birders now believe the combination of unusual weather patterns and the easier air travel of the day make for a record that will never be broken. For NPR News, I'm Mark Uricki in Akron.
The proliferation of Hollywood remakes. This year there have been more than a dozen, Conan the Barbarian and Arthur over the summer, opening today new versions of Footloose and The Thing, and soon we'll see Hollywood's take on the Swedish hit The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. So, with all these remakes, is there a failure of imagination in Hollywood? Well, our movie critic Bob Mondello says, let's reserve judgment. What you
want, what you got it. Otis Redding wrote and recorded a tune in 1965 that he made sound pretty good. All I'm asking for is respect when I come home. A couple of years later, Aretha Franklin remade it in her own image. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, take F-T-C-T. Anyone want to claim Otis Redding? The composer, let's note, did the definitive version? Was Aretha's remake a bad idea? Okay, I know, music is an interpretive art, but there are parallels in other disciplines, too. How different is it when Picasso models cubist images on a 300-year-old painting by Velázquez? And does the fact that Laurence Olivier was a legendary Hamlet in the 1940s...
To be or not to be?
Mean that Richard Burton can't be one in the 1960s?
That is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune
and Daniel Day-Lewis in the 80s, followed by Kevin Kline, Jude Law. Dame Judith Anderson even did a one-woman Hamlet, playing all the parts. If you're a theater critic, watching different takes on familiar roles is part of what makes the job interesting. Film is one of the few mediums where remakes, redos, and reinterpretations are regarded skeptically. Rap artists sample soul standards and no one bats an eye. Everybody loved it when John Steinbeck based parts of his novel East of Eden on the Book of Genesis, but say you're going to remake Footloose, and even if the original wasn't all that good, fans stomp their feet and say, leave it alone.
This is our time.
Film is a young medium, which may be why movie remakes strike people negatively. Shakespeare based King Lear on an ancient folktale, but movies don't go back very far, barely 100 years, and in a lot of cases the old versions are still around to be seen. Since 1903, Hollywood has made 29 Three Musketeers movies, an average of one every 4 years. What's left to do? Well, the teen-oriented one that opens next week will be the first to thrust its D'Artagnan at us in 3D.
The Three Musketeers. I came to Paris to be one of you.
Now, I thought Richard Lester's version was great fun in 1973.
You and the Queen need the services of a gentleman who is gallant, courageous, discreet, active, brilliant.
But I remember my elders saying then that Michael York's D'Artagnan wasn't buckling his swash nearly as thrillingly as Gene Kelly had in 1948.
Gentlemen, your quarrels are with me, not with each other.
And I imagine their elders poo-pooed Kelly in favor of Douglas Fairbanks in the 1921 Silent Musketeers. Okay, that doesn't really work on radio. Even so, young Logan Lerman in the 3D Musketeers has a lot to live up to, kind of like a composer who decides to reupholster a piece by a famous someone else. Ravel, for instance, got a commission in 1922 to revamp a little suite for solo piano that had never really caught on with the public when Mussorgsky wrote it in 1874. Ravel's arrangements made pictures at an exhibition a little more technicolor. And Mussorgsky's themes finally clicked with the public. Movie directors could sort of be considered both the composers and the arrangers of cinema, so it can be intriguing when a world-class talent decides to rethink someone else's work. Steven Soderbergh's snappy take on the crummy Rat Pack comedy Ocean's 11 felt like one-upsmanship. Gus Van Sant's shot-for-shot remake of Hitchcock's Psycho felt like homage. And the Coen brothers putting some actual grit into True Grit felt like a revelation.
This is like women talking. I think she is. You pretty well figured.
True Grit's the real deal, a retread that had more traction than the original, admittedly easier when the first movie is sloppy. But even quality originals can be overshadowed. There was a fine Maltese Falcon a decade before the one starring Humphrey Bogart, and Some Like It Hot reworked a funny German comedy that no one remembers anymore. So keep fingers crossed. The world may not need A Girl with the Dragon Tattoo in English, but audiences could do worse than having Fight Club director David Fincher making a case for it. And Great Gatsby with Leonardo DiCaprio next year? Well, he did pretty good work for director Baz Luhrmann in Romeo and Juliet, also a remake. And Luhrmann's Moulin Rouge, also sort of a remake, was certainly respectable. And Gatsby, remember, was a real believer in the redo.
You can't repeat the past. You can't repeat the past. Of course you can.
Of course you can. I'm Bob Mandela.
And at our website, you're invited to make the case for your favorite remakes. Go to npr.org.
One of the few bright spots for a music industry suffering from stagnant record and concert ticket sales has been the boom in popularity of electronic music festivals. Events featuring trance, dance, and dubstep, like Electric Zoo and the Electric Daisy Carnival, are now matching or besting their rock counterparts, Coachella and Bonnaroo, in attendance. But NPR's Sammy Yunigan reports that they're also drawing scrutiny from the media.
A bustling sea of music fans in their late teens and early 20s are stuffed onto a grassy, open field in New York. One stands out, dancing in a sweat-drenched black t-shirt that reads, "Sex, Drugs, and Dubstep?" This obviously isn't Woodstock, but in between the neon sunglasses and pink pills, remnants of hippie culture can still be seen in tie-dye and plumes of weed smoke. Electric Zoo is a three-day electronic music festival held annually on Randall's Island. This year, 80,000 people walked through the gates. On the other side of the country, the Electric Daisy Carnival drew 230,000 people. Ryan Radden, also known as DJ Cascade, was one of the DJs.
You know, people are like, this is the biggest thing happening in California. I'm like, dude, this is the biggest thing happening in the world. I got news for you. Like, I've played Creamfields. I've played all these festivals all over the world. There's not 250,000 people hanging out in the Coliseum every day. I mean, U2 doesn't do this. That's why it's like, well, you can't ignore it much anymore.
The thing is, electronic music festivals haven't been ignored. Instead, much of the attention they've received has focused on drug use. This year's Electric Daisy was held in Las Vegas after it got kicked out of the LA Coliseum following the death of a 15-year-old girl. Her parents are now suing the Coliseum Commission and the event promoter Insomniac. This past summer, a documentary about the festival caused a furor of its own when riot police were ordered in to control larger-than-expected crowds after Radden tweeted that he would DJ a free party outside of the event.
Nobody wanted that outcome. Right. That's not what was supposed to happen, but definitely the media, from what actually happened to what when I went back to the hotel and was watching the television, there was a huge difference.
After the premiere, Dan Turner of the Los Angeles Times published an editorial titled Electric Daisy Events Not Worth It for Los Angeles, writing, "If any city is equipped to handle an unruly crowd of young people high on drugs, it's Las Vegas."
We're really not editorializing against raves or against young people going to concerts. We're really editorializing against Insomniac because we've had a really bad history with them in LA, and we're happy that they've gone to Las Vegas.
The CEO of Insomniac countered with an editorial of his own, where he took issue with the term rave. Betty Kang, a publicist for the Electric Zoo Festival in New York, says that word carries a history of negative connotations that don't apply to events like hers.
Dance music was not allowed, or it wasn't in the club, so everybody had to go underground, and there were these underground parties, quote-unquote, raves, and there was no safety, no security. So I think those kind of situations created this negativity around it because they were illegal.
Now, coverage that focuses on the downsides of major music events is nothing new. Just ask Barnard Collier, who reported on Woodstock for the New York Times in 1969. He says that at first, his editors didn't want to cover the event at all, and then when he persuaded them, they wanted his story to fit a certain frame.
That was that these were a bunch of drugged-out hippies who were causing great trouble and catastrophe, cost the county of Sullivan tons of money, and should be closed down by the governor forthwith.
Collier didn't see it that way.
It didn't look like that to me, and I was perfectly happy. I'd done what I'd wanted to. I was ready to quit if I had to. And so I said, look, I won't write it if you don't put it in, like I said. And it caused alarm bells to go off all over the Times. It eventually got up to the editor, Scotty Reston. And Scotty Reston said, what we have to do is we have to write it as he sees it.
Nevertheless, the paper followed his report with an editorial titled Nightmare in the Catskills that opened with the line, "The dreams of marijuana and rock music that drew 300,000 fans and hippies to the Catskills had little more sanity than the impulses that drive the lemmings to march to their deaths in the sea." Today, Betty Kang admits there is drug use at Electric Zoo, but notes that the event has never had a drug-related death because of the amount of hard work that goes into it.
We work with the NYPD, we work with the fire department, we work with the New York City Parks Department to put on this event on Randall's Island.
For a lot of people, the music isn't about drugs, says Ryan Radden, who insists that much of the way electronic music is covered has to do with the fact that it's still crossing over into the mainstream.
Electronic music, mainly because it's new, does get tagged as something bad, as rock did and as hip-hop. I mean, dude, hip-hop still gets grief.
If past history is any indication, mainstream media coverage of non-mainstream events is as likely to stoke the flames as it is to put out any fires. Sammy Yenigan, NPR News.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia is produced by Mike Katziff and executive produced by Sarah Sarasin. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.